And of course, the Walnut Street Theater is now going to be producing some musicals, maybe one a year. It's 4:28. This is Fresh Air on WHYY 91 FM. And with me now is Toby Olson, whose latest novel, Seaview, was nominated for this year's Penn Faulkner Award. This is a literary award that is judged by a panel of writers. The judges this year are Toni Morrison, Walter Abish, and Richard Price, and the award will be announced sometime in May. Toby Olson is based in Philadelphia, where he teaches at Temple University. He's currently developing a master's degree in creative writing there. He's been an important figure in the Philadelphia poetry scene and was one of the organizers of the weekly poetry reading series at McGlinchey's. His books of poems include Maps, Worms into Nails, and The Wrestlers and Other Poems. Seaview is his second novel, and it's published by New Directions. I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much, Terry.
Before we talk about your writing, I was hoping you'd read a selection for us from your latest novel, Seaview.
Sure, absolutely. It'd be a pleasure. I'd just say a little bit about it before I read it. The context of it is that there are a man and a woman, Alan and Melinda, who are traveling across the United States. Melinda is dying of cancer and wants to get from Los Angeles to Cape Cod so she can spend her last days there. And Alan is a golfer who hustles golf on the way. This is at the end of the first chapter of the book, and it has many intentions, but one of them is to try to get quickly to some things about their relationship. He liked the feathered touch of her fingers on his spine playing some light music. She made little sounds when he sucked a piece of flesh on her arm into his mouth, making a circle. He bought her a silk scarf to keep her collars from chafing against her neck. She bought him a snakeskin wallet. He bought her pieces of Indian jewelry. She cooked him fancy desserts on occasion. When he carried her from place to place, he kept his hands flat and open against her flesh. She had a way of giving herself over to his carrying. He carried her often. He stood while he made love to her sometimes so as not to injure her body by pressing too hard against it. She bought him a silk robe, Japanese style, and turned her head away shyly. She ate everything still but favored things that were spoonable. He spoke to her while she was sleeping. Her skin had grown slack in its struggle, but there were no significant lines in it. He bought her a small flashlight. He liked the way her voice trailed off at the ends of her sentences. She bought him Johnny Walker Scotch and took an occasional puff of his cigarette. He found that even her thin waist had grown thinner when he placed his hands around it. She placed her lips on his neck when he carried her. He liked to buy her pieces of fruit. She bought him a knit shirt with an alligator on the pocket, and they laughed about it. He put the tips of his fingers into her mouth when he made love to her. She pointed things out in the landscape to him from the corner of the back seat. He had a way of moving to her before she called him. He liked to leave her alone and then return to her. He gave her money. She gave him room on her pillow. He bought her pieces of hard candy to suck on. She bought him small tools. She leaned against him when she walked. He gave her towels to press on her stomach. She made little sounds when he lifted her, air forced out of her lungs when his hand took her weight through her back. He liked to prop her up with pillows and chairs. She sang very quietly in the dark in the tub. He thought of her walking to his ball after he had driven. He bought her a curved shell from Africa to file her nails with. He liked the way she had given over control to him. She seemed very strong in the solid way she accepted the places of her helplessness. He liked it that she was a real burden. She gave him a small hemostat. He bought her thin yogurt in small containers. He liked the feel of her arm across his back when he carried her, her hand like a soft hook on his shoulder. He bought her loose underwear. He liked to watch her in her glasses reading framed in the rearview mirror. She seemed to like to catch his eye in the mirror and smile. She bought him a small notebook in which to keep their accounts. He liked the smell of her breath. Sometimes her fingers would caress the arm of the chair in which she sat. They drank tea in the evenings. He made a picnic of fruits and vegetables at a rest stop. They did not talk about things in detail. She made liver pate when there was a kitchen. They wrote no letters and received no mail. They had no friends. He bought her a pair of warm socks. She read many books. She seemed to be waiting for something other than her death. He took her to a baseball game in a small town in southern Arizona. They did not travel much on the superhighways, and he drove slowly. He liked the way she dressed herself with such care. He bought a gun. He liked the smell of the medicine bag. She bought herself a thimble after she had pierced her finger with a needle and it would not heal. He bought himself bright yellow cheap head covers for show. She had some trouble when she swallowed. He liked the way she was lighter each time he lifted her up. He bought her a stuffed stocking with the smile of a fat snake sewn into it for the small of her back. He told her stories of adventure and other details about golf. He told her stories about his childhood. She told him about the way sand drifted along the Cape. He bought her a music box the size of a matchbook. She liked the seriousness in his eyes when he was studying. He read very little but went over books in his mind. She bought him range balls at a market. She was pleased that he liked it, that she was finally reading Moby Dick. He liked the way she understood the behavior of other people. She liked the way he sweated when he made love to her. She was no longer curious about his secrets. He felt she had no secrets. She thought of his psychological insides as a series of mystery boxes, some transparent, others only half open, the rest opaque and totally closed off, shut off from his entrance completely. He was strong on the complexity of details. He rolled his eyes and laughed and laughed with her when she told him about his boxes. She liked the ways in which he had become physical with the cancer. He bought her books about the Indians of the Southwest. They both stopped taking each other so much for granted. She brought him a Coltrane tape, Meditations. He took her to see a pottery exhibition and found he was moved by it. He liked the way she liked to bathe in the dark. She thought seldom about the other people, the other possible men, lost days, and her lovers so many years ago back east. It's all right, goodbye, and no regrets. They walked short distances some evenings, but like young lovers or old people. She appreciated his sadness when he was sad. She left him alone with it, realizing it was proper and necessary. He was taken by the hardness of copper jewelry against her vulnerable skin. She liked the way, in her memory, he put a small red boat out from a dock. They talked about the congruence of their traveling dreams.
Thanks for reading that. That's a passage from Sea View, Toby Olson's latest novel, which has just been nominated for a Pen Faulkner Award. Were there any incidents in your own life that led to the writing of this novel?
Well, the golf, which plays a part in it, really doesn't enter as metaphor, but maybe it entered because of a certain guilt that I felt in playing too much golf. I took it up about 7 years ago. There's more to it than that. I also took it up on Cape Cod at a small local golf course, and the access to the local people in resort towns is often very difficult. And I was able to have that access through golf, and then I got taken with the game and fascinated by it. And I felt when I was writing about it, I was writing about what was in golf, and you know, not treating it as a kind of chosen metaphor, but one that I had in some way earned and therefore used in the book. Outside of that, I think reached an age now where relatives begin to die, and one sees death a lot, and therefore I think cancer enters, again, not as metaphor, but out of experience in that way. I suppose in the end, everything in the book comes from experience. In other words, if you were to mention a passage, I'm sure it would in some way tie into events in my own life.
I was surprised to see golf in the novel, because usually when people think of golf as being a metaphor for something or embodying something, it's something very bourgeois or related to, mm-hmm. like, businessmen on their time off. And it's really never used that I can think of, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. modern literature. Mm-hmm. I was talking to someone about this who suggested, yes, except for The Great Gatsby.
yes, absolutely, right. And also Winter Dreams, Fitzgerald's story, begins with a young man who's a caddy on a fashionable golf course.
Is it a maligned sport, do you think?
I think it is, but I think that's true of most any... I think that endeavors that are very locked into themselves and circumscribed and so forth, whatever they are, become fascinating. I love to go to the dentist office and look at magazines like Dog World. When I was a kid, I used to work at a collie kennel, and it was too young for me to be cynical about dog shows, but I remember being taken by the owner to a few dog shows, and it was just the intention, the technology, the vocabulary, the language, the passion with which people approach such a thing gave it a kind of dignity. And I think I feel that way about golf. But I would say that I would never have gotten involved in the sport, I think, if I'd been introduced in terms of some sort of country club setting. I frankly don't have access to country clubs, and I entered it with a lot of fishermen and local people on the Cape who play a different kind of golf. in the sense that it doesn't matter how you dress, and it's just a good old boy network of golfers. It's that kind of thing, you know.
When I think most writers have trouble sitting down for the day to do their writing. When you're writing a novel like this, every day you sit down, you're facing your character's death, who's got a terminal illness. Does that make the writing even harder?
I don't think so. In a way, for me, it didn't. It didn't make it harder, but it made it more obsessive, I think. I think the need to somehow understand it, or to figure it in a way that wasn't sentimental, didn't romanticize it in a certain kind of a way. Because I think that's one of the. It's not just illness, but I think it's specifically cancer. As Susan Sontag points out, becomes a kind of romantic illness, you know. And but I think that's true of most of what I write. I have a sense that I like to take cliche situations because I have a certain trust in them, and probably because I'm a very sentimental person, and try to write through them to the other side in some way. So it seemed to me the only way I needed to deal with it, and the way to deal with it was to exhaust it. So that the writing became, as I say, very, very obsessive, an attempt to say everything that I could possibly say about it, you know, and therefore redeem it in some way, I suppose.
Yeah, and in that Sontag book, Illness is Metaphor, she talks about how madness and tuberculosis in other times were really romanticized diseases. Mm-hmm. And I guess great examples of that are in movies where the person dying becomes more radiant and beautiful as they become thinner and closer towards death. How do you work with that kind of idea in your novel? You could see in the passage that you read part of the how he relates to her vulnerability, how he almost like treasures her increasing vulnerability, which is strange, really.
It is strange, but I think as I proceeded with it, the discovery for me was that was a problem with him as a character, and his retreat became either equally as obsessive as her concern with her own cancer. His retreat into golf became both an obsession and a retreat from her illness.
This book has been nominated for the Pen Faulkner Award. How do you treat awards?
Well, I haven't had much of an opportunity to treat them at all, so it means a tremendous amount to me, as a matter of fact. Both this novel and my first novel didn't get off to great starts commercially. I never had that kind of expectation, but I've been virtually ignored by the press in terms of reviews and the rest of it. And it wasn't going to deter me from continuing, but I can continue with another novel with great pleasure and joy now that this nomination has come through. It came out of the blue. It was a phone call, and I was told about it. And it was one of those things that I could. It seems to me there's so few things in one's writing in terms of recognition that you can feel are unadulterated, and I felt that this one was. It was just a great, great pleasure to get the nomination.
Had you or your publisher made any formal submission?
I'm not sure what the mechanism is. My sense of it is that all publishers submit all books that they think have any chance at all to the committee, and that must mean 500 or so books that are published during the year. And how those get treated, I don't know, you know, in terms of... But I do know that the three judges hand those books around. They do all of the reading. In other words, they're on first readers and things like that. So it was formally submitted, you know, in that sense, yeah.
The judges are Toni Morrison, Richard Price, and Walter Abish. Have you read their work?
I have not read Richard Price's work, but I have plans to read it. I value both Toni Morrison and Walter Abish very highly. How German is it? Won the first Pen Faulkner Award, as a matter of fact, and I had read it a year and a half ago and loved it. And the Song of Solomon I've not only read but taught a couple of times. So that makes it even better that one is chosen by people of such stature and people who I happen to personally respect.
Toby Olson is my guest if you're just joining us, and the novel that we're discussing, Seaview, has just been nominated for a Pen Faulkner Award. And the person who won that award last year was also at Temple University.
Yes, David Bradley.
Yes. Won it for the Cheneysville incident. You write your novels, and they're published on New Directions Press, and that's a publishing company that has been the first company to publish some great American writers. Does that press have a special significance for you because of their connection to to modern literary history?
Yes, it does have that connection. It has even a more powerful one. I remember when I was an aspiring writer, and I guess like most had not expectations or goals, but fantasies of, you know, where you would like your first poem to appear. I remember there were two places. One was Contact Magazine. I had the issues that were edited by William Carlos Williams and Nathaniel West, and I would fall asleep thinking about a publication there. I hadn't even written anything at that point. And the other place was New Directions. So that was the fulfillment of a kind of dream, I would guess, to have the book published there. Well, now that's happened, and it's been a few years, and I've had poems in there annual. So I suppose the romance of it is no longer an issue. But what is an issue is the fact that they keep things in print, and that to me is very, very important. My first novel was published in 1976, and it had a very small initial sale, one that I think, were I involved with a more commercial publisher, would have indicated that they would have remaindered the book and in these days shredded the books and so forth. And yet that book is still in print and still sells its share every year. And they'll keep it in print as long as it sells a book a year. And that's very valuable as far as I'm concerned.
Are you at the point where you're asking yourself what the trade-offs would be of publishing your next book with one of the major publishers?
I'm not sure I'm at that point. I'm not sure what that point means. In other words, would I be contacted or what have you? I do have an agent in New York who certainly urges me in that direction. On the other hand, I feel that unless I were to write a more popular novel with quotation marks around it, the expectation that most major publishers would have would always be far above the expectations at the best that I might have about what a book, you know, of the kind that I write ought to sell. And I feel a certain loyalty to New Directions, too. But I'm very willing to face that, be in a position to make that kind of a decision. We'll see in the future.
Do they edit your novels?
I'm hedging because the first novel, there was absolutely no editorial changes whatsoever. And with this one, there was an editorial session where I had sent the manuscript to ND from Cape Cod. And at the end of the summer, I came down and sat down with my editor there, and we spent about 4 hours going over it. He had edited it. He'd made a lot of editorial suggestions, and I think it was a very, very useful thing. I think about 10% of what he suggested ended up, entering into my choice for change. But it was a good process to go through. So the answer is they did in this specific case, but they don't in the sense that if you say absolutely not, up front, there won't be any editorial changes.
Do you go with your intuition when your editors made a suggestion?
No, I don't think so. It was very grueling, as a matter of fact. It was a matter there were certain things that I think that he wanted changed because he didn't have the same kind of personal take on them that I did, and I just said no, So it wasn't really it was tougher than that. It was more argumentative and,
I think that this is a period when a lot of people are writing poetry and want to be poets. You teach at Temple, and I'm sure see a lot of student writers as well as knowing all the writers in Philadelphia. What do you think?
Well, I hope that's happening. It seems to me that there was a lull for quite a while. I do think there may be a return to it. It's very hard to know in terms of things published, not just students, but things out in the world published, because certainly there are a lot more magazines, a lot more little magazines than there were for many years. So in a way, it's much easier to get things published in little magazines, which may in itself encourage people to write more, but I can't help but think that it's a healthy thing. But I'm not sure, but as I say, I'm not absolutely sure that there's any more, but that there isn't just more visibility.
Do you encourage writing as a form of self-expression?
Sure. Sure, absolutely. I've been, just this semester, I'm teaching at Tyler School of Art, and I teach a poetry workshop out there whenever I get the chance. And I think for most of my students there, they're involved in their own art, and they don't see it as somehow central to their lives. That is to say, the poetry is central to their lives. But I'm always struck with how healthy it is for them. Of course, they're already artists, but for them to engage in a verbal art, and you know, it seems to always they always report that it enriches their own art and also their own experience. So now that's a pretty ideal circumstance to teach a Tyler in that kind of, you know, situation. But nevertheless, it gives me makes me feel that yes, it's a good thing to do.
I think some people are frustrated because people who are writing for the purposes of self-expression get convinced sometimes that their poems are really good and should be read and published, mm-hmm, and get very demanding about it. And it might be something that's perhaps more therapeutic for them than literarily interesting for other readers or listeners.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what I think. I think that often what passes for self-expression finally isn't. And that if what I take to be self-expression has to do with it's being received in some way. In other words, one doesn't express oneself in a vacuum. You do it so that other people will so that you can transmit it to other people in some form. And if that transmission takes place, it seems to be usually the case that the piece is pretty good because it has the power to translate those feelings into words and transmit them to somebody else. You know, so I mean it in that more limited sense, I guess, in terms of self-expression.
For several years, maybe off and on for several years, there were poetry readings at a bar in Center City called McGlinchey's, and that would happen every week or close to it. That's ceased to exist. I'm not sure when exactly that stopped happening.
Yes, we stopped that. That started when I first came to Philadelphia, and it seemed to serendipitously just fill a void, more than a void. People, for some reason, got very excited about it, and it was just a very exciting circumstance. We had large audiences, had a lot of poets came in, and it was a very good thing. It ran its course, as most of those things do. We went for 4 years and found that although we could bring some people in from New York, we had more or less had most of the people in Philadelphia who were actively writing read and maybe read twice, and it seemed time to end it, so we did. There's more now, though, than there were. There were a couple of years where there wasn't much of anything, it seems to me. But now the Robbins Bookstore on 13th Street has a reading series. The YMHA is getting more and more active with reading series. And I'm hoping that there, and I see some more information, more than used to, come out of University of Pennsylvania, where they always have ongoing series. But they've been fairly closed off in the sense that the publicity wasn't out. But it seems that there's more out now. So I think things are getting good again.
You think it's important to have that for the writers?
Oh, I think absolutely. Sure. If nothing else, the most important part about it is that it creates a place where people can come together who are writing and talk to each other. It can be a pretty lonely enterprise, and it's good in that sense.
In reading a little about you, I learned that you traveled apparently all the time when you were young. You went to like several different elementary schools and then high schools. Do you think that usually when you pick up and move to a different school or different city, it's a whole different set of friends that you make when you get there, and it could be very unsettling. Do you think that affected your either reading or writing patterns?
I think it did, yes, probably. Well, the feeling of it for me was the following. When I look at my own past, and I must admit most of what I write is autobiographically based, but that's probably trivial to say because I think it's true of most everybody. But traveling and living in different places, especially through grammar school and early high school years, I have a sense of my past as being very compartmentalized but very real. That is to say, each place is separate from each other. With a whole group of friends, a whole environment, a whole circumstance that's distinct from every other. So it's very fragmented. There's a great lack of continuity as far as I can see. And I think that's true about, I know my fiction has a great lack of conventional continuity in that sense. And I feel very, very comfortable with that because it seems to me very much like reality in the sense of what my own reality was. You know, I don't see it as being fragmented in the sense of seeing the wholeness as a positive value. So it's easy for me to work that way and certainly not feel that it's experimental in any sense at all.
Were there writers that you read when you were coming of age that made you think you wanted to write too?
I think so, but I can't say specifically that I was moved in that way. I used to read a lot of historical novels. I remember reading Kristen Lovren's Daughter and these large, you know, trilogies that one could lose oneself in, you know. That was the way. I suspect it was a substitute for television. We didn't have television in those days, you know. I mean, we could have had television. I'm not that old. But I figured it was much better that I was reading than watching television. But I think that that's all that it was, really, you know. And I can't think that I was influenced particularly in that sense, because I never really thought of myself as a literary person. As you know, I didn't have ambitions to be a writer in that sense. It just kind of happened, I think.
You're currently developing a master's degree program in creative writing at Temple.
Yes, yeah.
What kind of program are you trying to shape?
Well, we're going to start, first of all, in the fall of 84, and it's been many years in coming, I think. We have a lot of writers at Temple who somehow have been hired over the years. We're going to have a program with 6 full-time faculty, and in addition to writers in residence, we'll bring in. We'll be giving degrees in poetry, fiction, primarily, and then possibly in translation if we get some students, and also possibly in the future in nonfiction. That isn't altogether shaped at this point. The program will be pretty much half traditional master's degree courses and half creative writing courses. I think the reason we're doing well, I know that the reason we're doing it is because we have that powerful faculty of professional writers at Temple, and it seems reasonable to use them in this kind of a way, and they feel comfortable with being used.
What kind of admission requirements would you have?
They'll be pretty much the same requirements that are those for the master's degree in English, but we'll make liberal exceptions. That is to say, a bachelor's degree, ideally in English, but one with possibly 24 credits in English. But if we get a physicist who is a fantastic writer and an undergraduate degree in physics, we will welcome him with open arms.
Did you study in a writing program?
No, I didn't. No.
Do you wish that you did?
No, I don't think so, no. I feel that a writing program, like the poetry readings in Philadelphia, their health, connected to the way in which they're healthy, is that really what a writing program does is to bring people together so that they can create some sort of community, and as much that is valuable goes on outside of the classroom that goes on in it. That's why I think people come to writing programs, and one would hope that that's the kind of program we're going to have at Temple.
Well, good luck with the creation of that program, and congratulations on your nomination for the Penn Faulkner Award.
Thank you very much,
Terry. It's a very prestigious award.
Thank you.
Toby Olson has been my guest. He's a Philadelphia-based novelist and poet, and he teaches at Temple University. His latest novel, Seaview, which is published by New Directions Press, was nominated for a Penn Faulkner Award, which is an annual award that is juried by writers. This year, Toni Morrison, Richard Price, and Walter Abish are the jurors. The announced winner will be decided and announced, I guess, in May.
Yes,
right?
In May.
Well, it's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening on Fresh Air in just a minute, but first let's check in with shadow traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. On the Schuylkill Expressway eastbound, you find some heavy volume between Vine Street and South. Westbound, a minor delayed Vine, a little bit slow at City Line Avenue. Very heavy volume on the Roosevelt Extension this afternoon from the Twin Bridges through the Wissahickon Avenue off-ramp, and Hunting Park is slow between Wissahickon and Broad. It's about a 20 to 25-minute delay to get through the detour. Ray Street is very, very heavy from 17th Street through the I-95 on-ramps. Northbound 95 slow for about three-quarters of a mile approaching Ray Street. No problems yet. Southbound 95 off the Girard Point Bridge. Platte Bridge Detour Road is slow for three-quarters of a mile approaching Island, and northbound Island Avenue is slow from 291 through Bartram. Average speed there about 0 to 10 miles per hour. If you're on the Wissahickon Drive northbound, expect slow conditions, 10 to 15 miles per hour from Gypsy through Rittenhouse. No major problems into New Jersey across the Ben Franklin or Walt Whitman bridges. That shadow traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
That shadow traffic report was funded by Super Fresh. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, I'll be speaking with Ovid Damaris, who's the author of The Last Mafioso and a novel called The Vegas Legacy. So I hope you can be with us tomorrow afternoon. Jay Goldman was the technical director for today's show. The co-producer of Fresh Air, Danny Miller, is vacationing. Maeve McGoran is filling in for him. Dave Davies is our production assistant this week. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Noah Adams.
And I'm Susan Stamberg, with All Things Considered.
The fundamental misunderstanding about the Soviet Union is that they are 10 feet tall and they have the confidence in themselves and their technology to be thinking about surprise attacks on the United States.
Many members of Congress are off to different parts of the world on fact-finding missions. Some would like to see more of those trips made to the Soviet Union. That discussion tonight on All Things Considered.
And these stories, another national strike in Argentina. 95% of the workers there are not working.
The nuclear accident at Three Mile Island 4 years later.
And The Valley, a story of the future from Ursula Le Guin.
First, this news.
This is John Hockenberry. A federal judge in Boston today dealt a blow to Reagan administration efforts to sell oil and gas exploration leases off the Massachusetts coast. The decision temporarily halts a planned sale scheduled for tomorrow by the Interior Department of almost 500 tracts in the George's Bank area. The sale is opposed by conservationists and the state of Massachusetts, who say the exploration will damage the rich fishing reserves. Reporter Jeremiah Witten has details for member station WBUR in Boston.
Environmentalists and the state of Massachusetts joined forces to file suit against the sale because of concern for the local fishing industry and because of allegations that the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington ignored the recommendations of its Boston office that the sale be postponed. Douglas Foy of the Conservation Law Foundation of New England said today's decision confirms 3 years of worries that the government was pushing through the lease sales without considering their environmental impact.